Hello, this is Amy, and in this episode, AADL talks to Jeffrey Cox, Professor of History and European History at Albion College, about his participation in the 2012 film Room 237, a documentary that draws attention to a variety of interpretations of Stanley Kubrick's classic horror film, The Shining. Cox details many of the clues in the film, which he believes provides evidence of Kubrick's preoccupation with the Holocaust and World War II. I wanted to go ahead and start out giving anybody who might be listening a little background about what we're talking about, which is a documentary film that's come out called Room 237, in which several people are interviewed about their interpretations of Stanley Kubrick's film The Shining. And you have your own particular take on some of the subtexts and themes that you feel are in there. And I thought, why don't we just start with you telling us what you see in the film and just a little background on how you came about with your theory.
I'm a modern European historian, and my area of specialization is modern Germany and the Second World War. And it turns out that Stanley Kubrick, too, was very interested in Nazi Germany and very interested in modern history in general. And so when I went to see The Shining for the first time, I didn't know anything really about Kubrick. I had seen Dr. Strangelove, I had seen 2001, but I didn't really know anything about Kubrick. And I was disappointed in The Shining because I expected it to be a horror film because the 70s were the great age of Hollywood horror films, and it was not what I expected. But it was a film that kept nagging at me because, as you know, Kubrick puts a lot into his films, so there's a lot to think about if you're paying attention. And I went back to the film, and I found patterns of reference that seemed to be oriented toward the history not only of modern America, but modern Europe as it grew to power and extended its power across the world. And since my particular area of expertise is Nazi Germany, I began to see things in the film that seemed to me could be regarded as references to Nazi Germany and in particular to the Holocaust.
Do I hear some qualification in there? Could be referenced, or you feel?
Well, I think it is, but I understand when people say, I don't see it, because it's just a typewriter, it's just a number, it's just a color, it's just a piece of music that may have associations with that time and place in modern history, but don't necessarily constitute a subtext. I'm convinced, because I've not only studied the film, I've studied Kubrick's life, his career, his concerns, his other films, and it seems to me that these patterns of reference, both in terms of their form and content, can be found throughout Kubrick's work.
Can you elaborate a little bit on the specific things, the typewriter, the specific things you see?
Well, the typewriter is a German typewriter, an Adler, which is in fact, a German typewriter. Adler means eagle in Germany. There's even a stylized eagle on the typewriter. And we're introduced to the typewriter in The Shining in a one-shot. It's a close-up of the typewriter, and then Kubrick gradually dollies back, and we see the source of what we've heard on the soundtrack as a rather terrible booming sound. Bang, 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 bang. So it gives that typewriter a certain quality that is ominous. It isn't just a typewriter on a sunny day in May or February. And we see that Jack Nicholson, instead of typing on his work at the typewriter, is throwing a tennis ball against a wall, and the wall is decorated by sand paintings, Apache sand paintings. So arguably there's a reference there to what white European settlers did to the Native Americans. And then there's also this booming typewriter that has a certain ominous quality as an object. And if you're a German historian and you see an Adler typewriter that is presented in an ominous fashion, you can't help but think of the Holocaust. Because at the time Kubrick made The Shining, there was really only one great book on the Holocaust, Raoul Hilberg's The Destruction of the European Jews, which was published in 1961. He had trouble getting it published. Nobody was interested in that. Nobody wanted to read about it. Nobody thought it was significant. So he published it with a relatively small publishing company, but it became the first great work on the Nazi Final Solution. And Kubrick, sometime in the 70s, had read that book, and he recommended it to people. And as he was wont to do, he would read something that would excite him and he'd recommend it to everyone. He did the same thing with Freud's works. You have to read Freud because I've read it and he's really onto something. So the fact that Kubrick had read Hilberg's book, and Hilberg's book concentrates on the bureaucracy of The Final Solution. It's very much what were called desk murderers, people that sat at their desks typing orders and lists of names. And given that context, it seems to me at least arguable that one could say that Kubrick is using that object as a reference to an event in history.
And you say you've seen, you feel you've seen similar references in some of his other works. Can you mention a few?
The one that comes immediately to mind when you're talking about Nazis, of course, is Dr. Strangelove,
right.
And the advisor to the president. He has this has trouble when he's talking to the president of addressing him as Mein Führer, and he can't control his right arm, which is flying up in a Hitler salute on a regular basis. And so I mean, that's one of the great satires. It's arguably the greatest black comedy ever made. And Strangelove became a symbol of nuclear Armageddon, as it was then called. And that the face on that nuclear Armageddon was a German face, both in terms of the mastery of technology and the association with Hitler. And the fascinating thing about Dr. Strangelove, and I didn't realize it until many years after I'd first seen it, was that there are two endings to the film, which seems curious because the ending of Dr. Strangelove is rather definite.
Right.
The detonation of the Russian doomsday machine and literally the end of the world. But it's not the end of the world. Only Kubrick could have a second ending. And the second ending is Strangelove's promise that all of the proper people who have been chosen with the proper characteristics by computers are going to descend into mine shafts. And then after the radiation is dissipated, they will come up as a new master race to repopulate the world. And clearly, that's Strangelove's vision, and it's the other part of the Nazi enterprise, which on the one hand it was war, and the other hand it was the construction of a master race. So I think Kubrick very consciously put that into Strangelove.
Sure.
So that's one example of the subject matter of Kubrick's concern, the historical subject matter, and also the very indirect and subtle way that Kubrick constructs these references. He wants you to work. He doesn't just want to put it out there. He wants you to work because he thinks it's important to be intellectually and emotionally engaged in a film.
Even a horror film. You believe he deliberately put these into a horror film because he wanted you to think.
Even a horror film. Well, when you say even a horror film, I suppose you're raising the very legitimate issue of, is it inappropriate to put real horror into a horror film, which is about entertainment, which is arguably, and that would be another reason why you'd want to do it indirectly. You don't want to have Nazis goose-stepping through the Overlook Hotel. It might trivialize the whole thing.
On the other hand, why didn't he make a film that directly addressed the Holocaust?
Another
why
excellent
would he do
question.
It?
And the answer is that he wanted to. He said to one of his friends that probably what he most wanted to do was to make a film about the Holocaust, but good luck at getting all that into a two-hour movie. And he, in fact, in the early 90s, he found a property that he could use as the basis for a Holocaust film, a wonderful novel, which is actually a fictionalized memoir entitled Wartime Lies by Louis Begley, who was hidden as a child in Poland as a Catholic and survived, and then he wrote this devastating novel about how he had been robbed of his childhood. And he spent his childhood, among other things, growing up admiring the power and the glamour of the SS and the German army because he was identifying with the aggressor as a matter of self-preservation. And Kubrick was fascinated by this, and so he set about writing a screenplay and sending people out to find locations and producing things. And I interviewed his wife, and she said that she had never seen Stanley so depressed as during the time when he was writing this screenplay for his Holocaust film, writing it all alone. He didn't contact Begley. He didn't have any co-writers, which he usually did on other films. He wrote it all by himself, as if it were his duty to do it by himself. But in the end, he finally couldn't make it. So he did want to make a Holocaust film, but he never did. And I think it's because he had two basic reservations. One is the aesthetic. How can you get all that into a two-hour movie? It would trivialize it. You can't put that on screen and do it justice. Now, that's arguable because there have been arguably many great Holocaust films made. But I think the other reason was personal. He just found it too damn depressing. I mean, all of the Kubricks who hadn't emigrated with Kubrick's ancestors to America at the turn of the century died in the Holocaust. I found the records. Their villages were just wiped out. They all went to Belzec or Treblinka or Auschwitz. They were all gone. And he knew this, of course. And I just don't think he could bear it. That here's a man who has a reputation of being cold and regarding human beings with a cynical eye. But in fact, he wasn't cynical. He was just realistic. He wasn't as tough-minded as people thought. And I think while he wanted to use his films to address the human condition and the threats to human integrity and human life, especially in the modern era, he just couldn't face that. It was just too awful for him to face. And so I think it found its way into this horror film. And there are some scholars who have said that actually horror films are the one genre that deal with the subject matter closest to events like the Holocaust, horror and mass death and disaster.
Well, it also sounds like if, as you're suggesting, he was as consumed with that entire topic and had read as much as he had and had studied it, and his family history spoke of it, that it would be hard for him not to put that sort of thing into a work of art.
Levels of consciousness. Right. I think a lot of the things in The Shining are intentionally placed there, but the way in which he finally came to the decision to put these references in his film probably were the result of unconscious and subconscious impressions. He was the type of filmmaker who didn't use storyboards because he didn't want it all laid out. He had a firm idea of what he wanted to say, but then in the production of the film and shooting the scenes, he wanted to have the opportunity for himself and his actors to experiment and find new ways and do new things and perhaps take the subtext in different directions. And I bet that's what happened with The Shining. He had certain ideas that, oh, an Adler typewriter, there are going to be associations there. And it was one of his own typewriters. He loved German machines. He loved the fact that the Germans were so technologically able. And yet at the same time, of course, one of his great concerns was the incredible dangers that technology confronts human beings with. I mean, 2001 is a perfect example of that. That damn computer, Hal, goes crazy.
Well, that kind of brings up something else I wanted to add. You know, the Holocaust, horror, serious, very disturbing, upsetting stuff. But Stanley Kubrick, as you pointed out in Dr. Strangelove and even with Hal, he has a sense of humor. It's a smart-ass, subversive sort of sense of humor. And I'm wondering if, you know, maybe the number 42, which you said refers to 1942, is more along the lines of a Douglas Adams reference to the ultimate question of the universe and everything. Do you think he could be being silly, being funny, being...
Well, silly in a serious way, yeah. Because if you take Douglas Adams and 42 is the answer, Kubrick using his 42 says, you know what the answer is? It's mass extermination.
Yes.
So it's funny, but not so funny.
Right.
I mean, he was a great satirist.
He was.
His films are masterpieces in terms of how he can mix the serious and the humorous. There's always humor in his films. Dr. Strangelove is terribly funny, and it's the film about this horrible disaster, the complete destruction of the world. But it's one of those things where I think for Kubrick, as for the rest of us, you have to laugh because it hurts too much to cry. And that I think also, in a positive way, being able to laugh at something is a way of also beginning to try to master it, to be able to take it and say, we need to look at this. Humor will help us do that. And maybe once we've looked at it, we can problem solve and perhaps avoid the disaster. So I think all of those elements play a role in how Kubrick constructed his films.
So speaking of the documentary now, the Room 237, and the seriousness versus the more humorous. I got to tell you, I kind of felt some of those other ideas were a bit wacky. The moon landing, the hoax, what are your thoughts on that?
I don't get the moon landing. As a matter of fact, when I was after I had been interviewed by Asher, I found out that the moon landing guy was going to be in the film, and I said, well, actually, I said, the moon landing guy was on this blog that I was on. They had a radio blog, and I gave my story, and then he gave his story, and I told the director, Rodney Asher, the director of Room 237, that, you know, I'm a little concerned that about the possibility of the moon guy being in this film. He said, the moon guy is in the film. And I said, well, my concern is that my ideas, which I think have some basis in fact, could be discredited by this lunacy about the moon.
And the fact that the film, because you're not on there visually, I mean, sometimes you're not sure who's talking.
Right.
How did you feel about that?
Well, that's a problem with the film. On the other hand, you could argue that you're not so much invested in the people as you are in the ideas. And it really doesn't matter who's saying what in that sense, because you're invested in what the people are saying, and then you're getting all these wonderful visuals, these excerpts from Kubrick films and lots of other films by lots of other directors. And I think it does help you focus on the substance. The price, of course, is you're not sure who's saying what. Now, I mean, it is true that Danny wears that Apollo 11 shirt, but there could be a sweater, but there could be other explanations for that. Plus, my question is, there are two parts to the moon landing. The hard part is going to the moon. The easy part is filming going to the moon. Why would they do the hard part and then fake the easy part? What's the reason for faking the filming? I never understood that. I have a greater potential understanding for those who say we didn't go to the moon, because that is hard to do, and maybe you'd want to fake it. I don't know whether you could or not. But why go to the moon and then fake the filming? I never understood why filming it was such a problem that you'd have to fake it. That's the only idea that I find absolutely ridiculous.
I was sort of waiting for him to mention the eagle on the typewriter on your typewriter as being...
Well, the eagle has landed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
How do you feel The Shining compares to other Kubrick films? Do you feel it's a masterpiece of horror? Is it a good film?
Yes. Having seen it so many times over such a long period of time, I now think it ranks with the other Kubrick films. I don't have a favorite Kubrick film. He did, as you know, films in different genres. They all have the Kubrick quality and touch to them and approach, but they're very different films because they're in different genres. And I think I didn't used to like The Shining as much as I liked other films, but the more I think about it, the more I think that I should like it exactly as much as I like the other films.
I've heard so many people say that, and I guess I need to see it a couple more times, but never was one of my favorites either. But
it is cool, and it's extremely cool, so much so that there's a real problem with the Blu-ray edition of it. They tried to correct the coolness of the film. The film visually had a very austere quality. The colors were sort of washed out. They're very cold and silvery and blue. And the Blu-ray edition moves the color palette too far to red. And so you get these wonderful, lush colors early on in the film. But that means that the yellow tennis ball is now pink. And also they changed the aspect ratio. They changed it from 4:3 to 16:9. And that cuts off some of the visual information in the film. For example, there's one scene in which the 42 on Danny's jersey appears and disappears in alternate shots, and you can't really see that in the Blu-ray edition. So my advice to all you fans out there, get the non-Blu-ray edition, because it's in the original aspect ratio and it has the correct color adjustment on it. Well, and that's one of the reasons Stephen King really hated the film. He said it's so cold, but Kubrick wanted it to be cold because it's a film about death. It's about ghosts, which are, of course, people who are no longer alive. And so the whole film is about death, and so it should be cold and austere. And I think that was the sort of thing people were disappointed. I was disappointed. But the more you see it, the more you see the ideas behind it, and the ideas behind it justify the cinematography, the characterizations, the writing. It's all of a piece. And appreciating that makes you appreciate the film. And I really like it now, much more than I ever did before. He even ends up, I say in the film, and I'll say this in my introduction tonight, that at one point the typewriter that Jack has, on which he has been typing his play or his novel or whatever it's supposed to be, changes color, and it becomes light blue. And recently there was an interview online with one of the people who worked with Kubrick in the film, and he said, yeah, one day Stanley said, listen, take that typewriter over there and get it painted blue. So it was a different typewriter from the one you see earlier in the film that Jack was using, but Kubrick wanted a blue typewriter, and it's the scene in which Jack is having his dream of murdering Wendy and Danny, and the music that accompanies that scene is The Awakening of Jacob, which of course has all sorts of biblical and Jewish references, and it's about how Jacob is confronted with the awful awesomeness of heaven and the Lord and of eternity. And the fact that it was written by a Polish composer, Penderecki, who dedicated his life to exploring the themes of tolerance and intolerance, because as a boy he had grown up watching Nazis cart Poles and Jews off to concentration and extermination camps. So you've got this scene in which Jack is having this horrible dream, underscored by this music that references all sorts of aspects of death and the end of human life, individually and in large groups, and you've got a blue typewriter, and that reminds us that Kubrick tends to use light blue, among other things, as a sign of mighty, cold, and obscene power, and that typewriter is blue. And it's also true that light blue is a color that's associated with ghosts. So the whole idea of the other regions filled with the dead souls of human beings, obviously there's a theme there of death, a death of everyone. So I think that blue typewriter is, you know, substantive. And it's an example of very conscious intent on Kubrick's part. Get that typewriter painted blue. Even though it's not the same typewriter we've been using, it doesn't matter. It's the color that matters now. Because Kubrick was not a naturalistic filmmaker. He was a realistic filmmaker. He wanted things to be about real life, but he wasn't concerned about reproducing reality. He wanted to examine and analyze and comment on the real human condition.
And some of the things that came up in the film, the documentary, too, you know, you might be tempted to think that some of these things were even continuity errors, but not with Stanley Kubrick. It's hard to imagine. Like the one scene where the boy stands up and the pattern on the floor, the hexagon plan, is reversed. And that's a little strange. That's not, I would imagine, something that would be a mistake.
Well, I have plans to go to the Stanley Kubrick archives and see if in all the scenes, they have all of the sheets there that call for settings and scenes and so forth and continuity reports. You'd want to see whether there's any indication there, whether they didn't care, or it was in fact intentional in some way. No doubt Kubrick made mistakes in his films, because nobody's perfect, even Stanley Kubrick. That would be the proof, of course, because he was, as you say, very rigorous and very detail-oriented, and he spent months and months editing. Now, he would tolerate what you might call continuity errors if the scene otherwise had what he wanted in terms of content and intellectual and emotional force. For example, there's scenes in Dr. Strangelove of Buck Turgidson chewing gum in the war room. And there are shots away from him and then shots back to him. And you can see that the wrappers of the gum on the table have changed position. But Kubrick doesn't care. That's not important. On the other hand, he was rigorous in terms of using the visual space of his films and the incredible depth of field he usually had in his shots to use objects or the absence of objects as ways of communicating meaning. So I think, like the missing chair and table, I think that's probably intentional. At some point he saw that, whether it was in the shooting or the editing, we don't know, or at least I don't know. But I think he probably thought two things. One is, it could be a parody on horror films. Now you see it, now you don't. But I think also, and one of the other commentators mentions this in the film or alludes to it, the idea that things happen in those hotels, there's small details that are wrong that just want to put you on edge, saying that this looks like just a hotel and it's a quite respectable place where all the best people stay. All the best people, of course, are the people of power, of course, who are the most dangerous people. It's quite clearly the theme in Barry Lyndon and in The Shining, from which that line comes in both of those films. So I think those little details that are wrong are designed just to keep the audience at some subliminal level just a little concerned that things aren't right. That, oh, wait a minute, there's something wrong about this scene, but I'm not sure what it is. Well, that's a good attitude to have in a very dangerous world. There's something wrong here. And of course, we know there's something wrong here. I mean, damn elevator's filled with blood.
So is the documentary, is Room 237 about the intellectual rigor of Stanley Kubrick? Is it about fandom? Is it about film criticism?
I think it's about all of that. I mean, this is clearly a film made by someone who loves films for people who love films. If you like films, you'll probably enjoy this film, even if you think the ideas in it are the result of a bunch of crackpots thinking too much and looking at one film too often. But it is a film that celebrates film as entertainment and film as art and film as production of ideas. And certainly that's appropriate for Kubrick because he was a very intentional modernist filmmaker who wanted his films to say things. He was incredibly well-read, and he put a lot of research. He only made 13 films his entire career, and he'd spent, as you know, months and years researching these things. And that involved a lot of reading and thinking, and he talked to everybody. So his films are filled with ideas, and that's why they're worth seeing over and over again, because they have intellectual and emotional power, and then there are all these little details that will help underline or introduce you to new ideas that you hadn't thought about before.
For more information about the documentary Room 237, visit room237movie.com. Music for this episode was As the Ruin Falls by D.P. Kaufman, which you can find on the AADL catalog by going to aadl.org/magnatune. AADL Talks to Jeffrey Cox has been a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.